It's time to talk about the outdoors in South Alabama. Hunting, fishing, and getting outside along the Great Gulf Coast. It's time to take it outside with FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. With reports, stories, how-to information, and Dr. Bill's Marine Forecast. Here's Sean Sullivan and Mike Ward.
Right away we go. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors brought to you by McConnell Buick GMC. Big thank you to those folks, and glad to have you here. My buddy Captain Mike, how are you?
Doing great this morning. How about you, Sean?
We all right. And a lot of fishing to talk about on today's show. And some of the fishing and how-to, but I want to get in a conversation about a subject. We mentioned it when I first heard about this. Gosh, months ago or maybe a year ago, I brought it up on the show for a second. But Then I realized I would, a little bit outside my coverage on my knowledge of it, just a little bit of it. And we're lucky this morning. I have a guest joining us to talk more about, I call them pogey boats. Yeah, I'm sure the official will be menhaden,
Pogey seine boats, yeah.
And,
ships, or whatever.
As we look at this, we think about kind of the building block when it's not shrimp for us, it's pogies.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about the building block of what feeds the fish we go after, it's pogies. What do you and I sit trying to cast net for before we go offshore fishing?
Pogies.
Right. What are, when you see you're riding down and you see pelicans dropping on a school of something by the ICW, it's pogies. You're going to stop in there and catch some redfish,
that's
right?
That's right. Yeah.
And so we think about pogies maybe as sportsmen just from the, let's throw the cast net and get some for snapper or make a great speckled trout bait too up in the rivers, but I really never thought about them in depth on a commercial aspect, until it really was triggered for me last year when you and I were fishing out of Mississippi, because we had closed here in Alabama. We had closed here in Alabama. We went over there and launched there to go snapper fish. And I guess over the years, I just never thought about that facility that's right there.
The one that stinks so bad.
Well, got me thinking more of the commercial side of it. And so there's a lot to talk about here. And we have somebody who has been looking at this for a long time and can fill in a lot of these questions for us. Director for the Center for Marine Fisheries with the Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership, Chris Macaluso, checking in from Louisiana here on FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Thanks for your time, Chris.
Sure. Good morning, gentlemen. How y'all doing?
We're doing good. And although by the time we get done with this conversation, people might be sinking down in their seats a little bit here, because this is something that you've been on, you've been talking about, but I don't think a whole bunch of people know about. Maybe they do over in Louisiana more, but I can tell you in Alabama, you and I show up at the boat launch and ask about this. It's not the majority of people that know about what's going on with the pogie boats. Can you first of all talk about what you do with every day with TRCP, and then kind of explain this issue to us?
Well, I appreciate you guys having me this morning. Sure, I'm the director of marine fisheries for the Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership. We're a nonprofit. I'm sure that your listeners have heard of some of the groups that we work with, like CCA Alabama, like CCA Nationally, National Wild Turkey Federation, Ducks Unlimited, American Sport Fishing Association, on and on. And we work to, improve access and improve management for hunting and fishing across our country. A big focus of our organization right now and the work that I do on marine fisheries is, working with the federal government to improve snapper, snapper access regulations and, getting state management accepted, improving those season lengths, improving that, looking at that for other fisheries as well, both in the Gulf and the South Atlantic, up the Atlantic coast, but also working on managing our forage base. And as you guys mentioned, menhaden or pogies, as we call them here in the Gulf, are a huge part of the forage base for speckled trout, redfish, jack, shark, king mackerel, tunas at times, go up the list. They're a big source of food, and I don't think a lot of folks know, but, about 1.2 billion pounds or so of those fish are harvested every year in the Gulf of Mexico and ground up into animal food, and, the oils are used for cosmetics and all kinds of stuff. It's a big industry, but we feel like it's having a real detrimental impact on our beaches and on our fisheries.
Once again, I'm still in shock. One plus billion pounds?
Yeah, it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 1 to 1.5 billion pounds annually that are caught in the Gulf. And, you know, about 80% of that catch is off of Louisiana's coast, and some of it's off of Mississippi, and there's some off of Texas. But most states have some pretty stringent. Alabama and Florida, for instance, have some pretty stringent regulations, so you don't see a lot of that activity taking place there. But Mississippi, Louisiana really is where that harvest takes place, and most of it's off of Louisiana.
Well, here in Alabama, they can use nets, but they can't use a purse seine net to catch pogies with a big boat and everything where they catch everything in the world. And, so it's a little different.
Yeah, and that's one of the things I want to – so first of all, we're talking about this forage base that's important, the big input into the system, and then there's the commercial side of this. You said it. I guess let's back up for a second. Describe the difference between a regular net and a purse seine for people who haven't studied this.
Sure. What you guys are seeing, in Alabama is strike nets and nets and things like that, and that's mainly a bait fishery. You know, that's guys who are harvesting pogies to freeze and to use as bait for crabbers and for fishermen and stuff. And we don't have an issue with that. Where our big issue is these large industrial ships. You know, we're talking about 180, 200-foot vessels. They have smaller vessels that are about 30 to 40 feet on them. They deploy those smaller boats, and they use airplanes, too. They use airplanes to spot the big schools of pogies.
I've seen the airplanes, too.
Yeah, and you'll see them flying along the beaches and in the bays and stuff. They spot the big schools. They deploy these smaller boats. And they wrap a net around this school of pogies, and the net's probably, you know, about half as big or a little bit bigger than half the size of a football field. And when they encircle that school of pogies with that net, they catch everything that's in there eating those pogies, too. And a lot of that stuff gets sucked up by a vacuum into a large container ship. You know, that's that 100-foot, you know, that 200-foot vessel. And then the stuff that can't get sucked into the boat that's too big bounces off of some guards that are on the deck, and they get put back in the water. And a lot of the fish that are getting put back in the water are bull redfish, you know, breeding stock redfish, big jacks, sharks, you know, sometimes it's tarpon, sometimes it's mackerel, and they're going back in the water dead, frankly. And we see a lot of that in Louisiana. We see a lot of dead redfish floating in our surf during the summertime when those boats are in there harvesting those menhaden.
Yeah, I mean, just the thought process, all of us at fish know, like, you're coming up on a school of pogies, you're going to it because the fish are around it. We know that, right? And
they're, sure.
That's why we're going there. So we can already picture what's around a school of pogies like that. And then you think about it as a sportsman and a conservationist, what we do to limit harvest of breeding class redfish and what that has done. You know, a show doesn't go by. I'm 48 and I say I'm living, you know, in the best time in my lifetime for red fishing compared to when I was a boy. It's gotten better and better over here, the fishing for redfish. But that's because we protect that breeding stock and we're limiting ourselves. We put our own rules in place as conservationists. And then you tell me there's a commercial fishery that's just killing them? Just go ahead and kill them.
Yes. That's 100% accurate, and that's the way it is here in Louisiana, too. You know, and we, in our lifetime, you and I are about the same age. In my lifetime, in our lifetime, we did see a lot of those breeding stock redfish get killed by commercial fishing, mm-hmm. and we put a stop to that. We made redfish game fish. We stopped killing those big breeding stock fish, those 27-inch-plus fish. We let them swim, but now, you know, you've got these menhaden boats, these pokey boats, that a large percentage of the bycatch that they're killing are these breeding stock redfish that are on these beaches in these shallow water areas feeding on these menhaden and spawning. And, you know, when they're in there eating the menhaden and the menhaden get encircled in this big purse seine net, there's no way for those redfish to get out, and they go back in the water dead, you know. And it's sickening to see. It's sickening to see it, and that's why organizations like CCA and TRCP and so many others have been working to try to at least move those boats off the beaches into deeper water where the interaction with those redfish is going to be lessened, and we don't see those dead fish floating in our surf zone and washing up on our beaches.
And what about porpoise? I know they got to catch porpoise in there, and they're probably killing those too.
Well, there's been pretty limited observer coverage, and I can say I don't know that we've seen a lot of dead dolphins turning up from them. I mean, I think a dolphin is probably a little bit smarter than a redfish, probably mm-hmm. find its way out of that net. But again, we don't know that for sure. We know that in the wake of these boats, we do see dead redfish. We see dead jacks. We see dead sharks a lot of times. Anything that can't, they're not allowed really to retain any of those fish as bycatch. So there are what they call shark guards on the boats. And when those fish get sucked up into the hose, if they're too big to go into the hold of the boat, they get kicked out. Generally, they're dead when they get thrown back overboard. Now, anything else that they're catching, speckled trout, smaller drum, croakers, mullet, crabs, et cetera, that do go into the boat, they just get ground up into animal food or cosmetic oil or whatever, with the rest of the folks.
I mean, this is people hearing this for the first time will think about, limits on, the self-imposed game fish limits, right? Speckled trout, we got limits. You mentioned tarpon earlier. We think about what it is. If you want to kill a tarpon here in a kill tag in Alabama, how to do how tightly we regulate some of those. This is just being either killed or killed and processed game fish species along with the pogies. I mean, it just sounds like it's a matter of business here.
Well, that's exactly what it is, and they're allowed a certain amount of bycatch by law, and there are the menhaden industry, the pogie industry will argue, well, our bycatch is relatively low. Our bycatch is less than 3% of our total volume. Guys, we're talking about 1.2 billion pounds of fish.
Yeah, right. Yes.
And so when you're talking about 3% of that, you're talking about an awful lot of dead fish. Dead unintended fish that are going either in these boats or getting kicked back out into the surf dead.
And you talk about breeding stock, too. You big fish and breeding stock. All critters have a value, but I got to tell you, I may look at things in not the perfect way for many hearts out there, but a bull redfish is more valuable than a 16-inch rat red because there's way more rat reds than there are bulls, and bulls and gals make more redfish. They're more valuable.
Correct. No, you're right. You're right. That's why we have put such a priority on protecting those fish, because we know that the 16, 18-inch redfish that we like to catch up in the caves and in the marsh, they get made by those breeding stock.
Right.
So it's important to have that healthy stock out there. And there are some preliminary studies. Now, the Gulf States Fisheries Commission has been looking at what's called ecological management of pogie harvest, which means taking into account the bycatch, taking into account how many menhaden, how many pogies need to be in the water for the big fish like redfish and jacks and mackerel to eat. Mm-hmm. And throughout looking at this study, some of the preliminary numbers say that, through a combination of bycatch and a combination of limiting the food source, that we could be looking at some pretty significant reductions in the speckled trout, redfish biomass because we're removing so many pogies from the Gulf. It's a serious problem, and we're having the state legislature here in Louisiana look at it. At least trying to establish some protected areas off of our beaches where these boats can't go in. They can't go in and run aground. They can't go in and harvest fish in those close-in surf zones where we know the majority of the fish, the fish interactions are taking place in that surf zone.
Has there been any study where the pogie that they're catching, say, in Louisiana, with these boats, they're catching the same amount of pogies every year, or is the pogie count going down, pogie count going up for them? It'd be interesting to know if they're hurting the pogie population, too.
Well, there are some studies that show that the pogie population in the Gulf is pretty high, and that the harvest that they're doing is a relatively small amount. But we're also talking about looking at Gulf-wide numbers in terms of estimating the population of pogies, but you got to think about all the extraction, all the removal mm-hmm. that's taking place in a relatively small area off of Mississippi coast and mainly off of southeast Louisiana. And so, not only are these fish critical food sources, Not only do we have scientists who believe that that damage is being caused to our beaches and habitat from that fishing activity, but they're also critical filter feeders, which means pogies take a lot of nutrients. They take a lot of a lot of nutrients, a lot of plankton and things like that out of the water column, and that leads to healthier waters. For all fish, healthy water for everything that swims out there. And if you're removing that amount of biomass from that smaller area, it can't help but have an impact on water quality as well.
And we come back from the break, we talk more about that. It's a subject that I think a lot of us hadn't thought about back here at home. And we're getting an education on it right now. It's Chris Macaluso, our guest with the Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership. He's out of Louisiana looking at this. So, I mean, it's a Louisiana issue, but, y'all, we've been taught it's all one big gulf. And what happens there affects us here. Be right back. Back, FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Glad y'all are here. And a conversation that is probably opening a lot of eyes in our neck of the woods about the pogie boats and the bycatch that goes on with that. And talk about this with Chris Macaluso from the Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership. Hey, Chris, too, as we're talking about it here, can people, I guess, what would you have them Google, if they want to see pictures of what we're talking about or find out more, if you've written on this, which I know you have, where do they go get more info?
We worked with CCA Louisiana to put together a really great web page that's got a lot of video links in it. It's got a lot of information about what's happening with pogie harvest. As you mentioned, it's mainly off Louisiana, but it's Louisiana and Mississippi, so I think a real good place to go right now would be the CCA Louisiana website, with CCALouisiana.com. And there's a link up there that says Protect Our Surf Zone. And that's going to have a ton of information about what's happening right now with pogie harvest and what CCA and TRCP and several other conservation groups are doing to try to put some common regulations on that fishery.
And go ahead, Mike.
I was going to say, where you see most of the pogie fishermen, and you said southeast Louisiana, most of that's going to be between like Chandelier, Curlew, Breton, and Biloxi Marsh and in that area. Is that right?
Where a lot of it takes place in the Breton Sound area. And the reason for that is because you've got a processing plant right there in Burris, which is on the river. You got another one in Mississippi. So some boats from Mississippi and some from Louisiana are fishing that Breton Sound, Mississippi Sound area. But you've also got a processing plant, that same processing plant that's in Burris, fishes the west side as well. And that's really where we see a lot of the activity very, very close to the beach. We're talking sometimes 100 yards or less from the beach. Sometimes you've got boats out there stringing nets. And we see a lot of dead redfish as a result of that. And there's a lot of people very concerned that those big vessels operating in that shallow water are affecting water quality, and they're disturbing the surf zone. And another thing to take into consideration is we've invested, millions and millions, if not over $1 billion at this point, in restoring those barrier islands, Hurricane Katrina, and especially since the oil spill. And we want to see those areas protected. And having 180, 200-foot vessel that shallow running aground is certainly not protecting those beaches.
It isn't. And what you mentioned that, Chris, about the amount spent for restoration, but also think about the amount of money states have spent and sportsmen have spent to have a healthy population, and limits that we have put onto ourselves. You have excise taxes and things that contribute to fisheries and fisheries projects. Then you have science. The best science comes out, and we listen to it as sportsmen and say, the limit needs to be this, or we need to not kill big red fish. And we do all these things to make that population better, and then you say, and then there's this fishery with an acceptable bycatch that could be at a number that is hard to fathom with the number of dead redfish described there. And, redfish, bulls and cows making baby redfish in Louisiana benefits Alabama. Alabama benefits Louisiana. Mississippi gets it from both of us. I mean, we're all together in this.
No, that's 100% correct. And we recognize that the nursery grounds in the Mississippi Delta, places like Breton Sound, parts of Louisiana's coast, you know, some of our bays and areas and estuaries. You know, it's not just about Louisiana. Those areas feed the rest of the Gulf. Mm-hmm. You know, we grow menhaden here and shrimp here and stuff like that that migrate all across the Gulf of Mexico. And so when you're having an impact on that fishery here in Louisiana, it's not just Louisiana that gets hurt. And we could be talking about as many as 100,000 or more dead bull redfish in Louisiana a year. I mean, that's a lot of fish when you think about it.
It's
especially galling when you go to a beach, you know, or you're a charter boat captain, you're taking customers from out of state, or you're somebody taking your kid to Elmer's Island or Grand Isle, and you walk up there and you see these dead fish washed up on the beach. It ought to turn your stomach. You know, it's something that, as conservationists, should not be acceptable.
It's like Chris was reading my mind, because what he's talking about on the west side of the river, I was going to ask him. I said, yeah, thinking beach, and I was thinking Grand Isle and Elmer's Island. Right, man, how many times in my life camped out in a tent back there in the old days and surf fished, and just the biomass of fish that was off there at Elmer's Island. I can't imagine what could get caught up in those nets. And you mentioned Louisiana, and this is what I want to come back to, because people may not understand this conversation. We're focused on Louisiana, and we're not focused on Alabama, Florida, and Texas. So it's a state-regulated fishery, right? So Louisiana says those boats can do that, right? It's not the feds.
Well, the majority of the harvest takes place in state waters, correct?
Okay.
So if you look at Alabama, they have restrictions, you know, pretty mm-hmm. hard geographic restrictions. It don't allow those purse seine boats to get up on the beaches. You look at Florida, that doesn't allow the purse seining. You look at Mississippi, has even got some boundaries around their barrier islands and some of their beaches by as much as a mile to keep the boats away. And Texas has got caps, you know, harvest caps. It's really Louisiana, and it's because there are two processing plants here. There used to be more than that. You know, the menhaden industry is lucrative. They're very well connected politically, and they've done a good job in places like Louisiana, Mississippi, and Virginia, where their big processing plants are, of making themselves a moving target.
They a moving target? Like, what do they do?
Well, you know, they're managed, you know, a lot of times they're managed politically. You know, mm-hmm. you look at the Gulf Council, for instance. The Gulf Council has very little control over the menhaden industry in the Gulf. You know, NOAA has very little control over them, or very little say. There is really no harvest limit on menhaden in the Gulf of Mexico. It's managed by the Gulf Commission, who, you know, does scientific examinations, but really doesn't have the capability of setting any kind of catch limits or anything like that. And so what they've done is they've kind of layered themselves into all kinds of different jurisdictions, you know, state commissions, you know, to a certain extent, the Gulf Council, to a certain extent, the Gulf Commission, you know, to a certain extent, state legislatures. And, you know, it's hard to go to one particular entity and say, hey, we need you to control, or we need you to limit, you know, this menhaden activity. So it's a difficult political situation, but I think we're making some headway. We've seen progress made on the East Coast. In terms of establishing what's called ecological management of menhaden, we've seen the Atlantic States Commission be able to put hard catch limits on menhaden, especially in the Chesapeake Bay. And I think that's what we're going to try to move to, is certainly what we're moving towards in the Gulf of Mexico, is recognizing the need for those fish to be in the water as food, recognizing the need to put hard harvest limits in areas where those big boats can't go.
These companies, two major players, right? Are they, and did I read that they're not American companies?
They are both foreign-owned companies, correct. The Omega Harvester is owned by a Canadian company that's generally interested in making fish meal to feed farm-raised salmon. The one in Buras, Louisiana, is owned ultimately by a South African company.
So neither of these companies are American companies?
They're corporately, they're not American companies. Okay. They do hire Americans. You
right.
know, we will concede that. You know, there are people who make their living partway off of running these boats, but no, they're not American companies.
How about that?
Yeah, think interesting. And folks, when y'all Google this and you go to CCA Louisiana site and elsewhere, read up on this, you get some of this education. I wonder how much. And this is there is science done on it, but we notice, like, okay, when the oil spill hit. right? And we shut down commercial harvest of fish. It really shut down recreational, except for a little part of Mississippi Sound during that. In the years to follow, that year and the years to follow, and we just talked about, you know, Captain Bobby Abrascaldo and I were talking about it the other day, Mike, that like our croaker drags, when we went with our little bait nets
sure.
to drag for croakers in that year after, the difference in the number of just the, you drag your bait net for 3 minutes and shut it down and pull it up because it'd be full. I wonder how much of this, as we talk about putting those hard limits, Chris, on these pokies, and that's that building block, not only not killing as many bull reds and other fish, but more food out there. Is there something, is there been any science on how that could increase the overall biomass in the Gulf of game fish because of the bait fish there? Is there anything like that out there?
Well, they're in the process. You know, we expect to see a study come out of the University of Florida and out of NOAA and the Gulf Commission, you know, sometime this spring or summer that's going to start laying the foundation of what ecological management of menhaden would look like. But I do find it, and some of the preliminary indications, and this is a presentation made to the Gulf Commission last year, some of the preliminary indications are that you're seeing significant reductions in biomass of species like trout, redfish, jacks, tunas, et cetera, because of menhaden harvest. You know, it's hard to put a number on that right now, but okay. I think that study will give us a little bit more definition to it. But I think something interesting to point out, you know, we've been debating this at the Louisiana Wildlife Fisheries Commission for the last year or more. And some of the biologists have said, you know, we haven't seen a significant reduction in redfish biomass because of this fishery.
Huh.
Well, the question is, though, how long have we been doing this in Louisiana? You know, we've been harvesting somewhere between 1 billion and 2 billion pounds of menhaden off Louisiana's coast and Mississippi's coast for almost the last century. So
Wow. Unless
you've got information that predates that, we really don't know.
Right.
You know, we really don't know.
Yeah, what is the baseline? What is that baseline? We don't know.
Right, exactly. We don't know what this place could look like without that. We don't know what the productivity of those fish or the fecundity of those fish, you know, the ability to reproduce and sustain more fish. We don't know what that looks like without this fishery in place, you know? Right. And so it's hard to come out and say definitively that this fishery and its bycatch is not having a significant impact on speckled trout redfish populations because, frankly, they don't know. You know, and that's another thing that we're pushing for. It's not just to move them off the beach legislatively, which is something we're working on this legislative session in Louisiana, but we want more thorough studies. We want to know what ecological management looks like. We want to know. We want more observer coverage when it comes to the bycatch, you know, to what's going into these boats and what's getting kicked out dead. Because to this point, the studies have been, you know, largely preliminary. A lot of them are out of date. They don't take a real hard, close look at the fishery in a comprehensive way. And we think it's time to do that.
Absolutely. And y'all, we're never going to look at a school of pogies popping the same way again, are we, after hearing all this? Chris, we appreciate your time. I got to get you back on the show maybe after this legislative session in Louisiana and talk more about it. Plus, I mean, get you on. I want to talk about how the marsh is looking and, you know, how the projects are looking at how much land is being built down towards Venice, how much we're still losing, all that kind of stuff. So hopefully we can get you back on the show soon.
No, anytime. Just give me a call.
Thank you, Chris.
All right, guys. Thank you.
There he is, Chris Macaluso, our guest. So how about that eye-opener? It was for me, for sure.
$1.23 billion. I look at it like
pounds.
Real estate.
Yeah.
I'd like to have 3% of $1.2 million sale.
Yeah.
I would retire.
Coming right back. Right, welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Sean Sullivan, Mike Ward, glad to have you all along. Brought to you by our friends at McConnell Buick GMC. And a big thank you to Chris Macaluso with the Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership. And what was an eye-opener for me when I first stumbled onto this.
I think it's an eye-opener for a lot of people around here because we don't see those poking
right.
boats around here. And I see them. when I go fishing.
You
Louisiana.
Spend a lot of time over there, right?
Yeah, I see them, and I see the airplanes circling and locating the menhaden for them to take and put the and nets out.
And we can discuss the how many pounds and tons of menhaden they should take in a commercial thing. That's but y'all Google this stuff and you see the bycatch pictures of. I mean, I guess it frustrates me more as a sportsman, too, that all the things we do to protect bull reds, and let alone we're talking about tarpon, we're talking about trout, we're talking about jacks, we're talking about shark, all these other fish. But just think about this in bull redfish. Yeah. Redfish, all the things we do to say you can only kill one and you shouldn't kill any and how much time we take releasing one after we catch it and knowing the value to that fish. Here we are with kid gloves dealing with individual redfish, and then you find out hundreds of thousands of pounds of just dead redfish on the side of these boats. I mean, bull reds, too. And you're like, what am I doing? Yeah. What am I doing? I'm busting my hump over here to do this, and what am I doing there when that's just part of a day's work?
Well, that net is not discriminating.
It does not care, right?
They catch everything, Spanish mackerel, speckled trout, redfish, croakers.
And they're right up by the beach, he says, so in a lot of those situations where there's tons. And where he mentioned Grand Isle and Elmer's Island, I used to camp out and fish there, and you would see those waves break. That's why it made it so fun to be down there. You see those waves break, and you see it off Dolphin Island sometimes, but not like this, y'all. You see the wave break, and the whole wave column is full of fish.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
I mean, trout and redfish and jacks and sharks. And I mean, you're looking out there, and you're like, every time one of those waves lifts up and the sun could cut through it, you're like, it's like there's 500-600 fish right there.
Yeah.
It's just of all kinds.
And you couldn't catch a one of them, could you?
We caught all of them. There's a do you think that, okay, here we go. Do you think the fishing was good? We used to camp out for multiple nights in the summer heat of South Louisiana in tents on a beach.
That's the place that doesn't have any mosquitoes over there, too, right?
We'd always want a south
no
wind.
No gnats.
You'd want a big south wind. It made it tough. You were kind of always back and forth because if you got a south wind, it meant it was rough when you're surf fishing.
Yeah.
But it blew the mosquitoes and the gnats back some.
Right.
It'd turn around and get a little bit of a north wind or an east or west or northeast or west. Yeah, man. But I survived.
We'd do anything to catch
fishing
a fish
was that good.
Or shoot a turkey or a deer or whatever. We've done it all.
Fishing was that good.
Yep.
Talk some fishing here. And also, I've got a couple stories I want to throw in the mix, too. I got a gator story.
Okay.
Usually, we don't, like, I guess while everybody else in media gets all up for whatever gator story they have, and I go, okay, well, that's gators doing what they're supposed to do. And yeah, it doesn't seem like a story to me. Evening news, like, alligator on the causeway. Well, they're supposed to be on the causeway, you know. So it's a rare story that gets my attention about an alligator, but I found one. Mike, I found this one. This is from the independent.com, and it's about it's a gator story out of South Carolina. Okay. 12-foot alligator caught in South Carolina. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's a big gator. 12 foot's a big gator.
Yeah, it is.
The next sentence here got my attention in the story. Had 5 dog tags inside that were almost 25 years old.
So I guess the dog tags don't pass through, huh?
Correct. So this is, you know, you've heard these stories over time. They open up a shark, open up a gator, and it's got all this stuff in its stomach.
Right.
The story said, 12-foot alligator caught in South Carolina was found to have had 5 dog tags inside its stomach that were nearly 25 years old. And this is what's interesting, that they could read one of them, because I like duck bands, right? If you get a duck band that's more than a few years old, I've got some at my house or in my lanyard that are real tough to read because sand and silt and grit gets, you know, and sands them down over time. You got to imagine there's some gnarly stuff in a gator's stomach
start.
Okay, it said, so... This is English people writing it. They said the 445-pound beast was trapped by hunter Ned McNeely in Ravenel outside Charleston, who took it to the taxidermy shop and butcher shop. They point out that he's getting meat made out of it or getting processing. All right. And then it says inside the animal's stomach. So they takes it to the processor. He's going to get skinned. So the processor said, hey, you got to see this. Inside the animal's stomach, the shop owners find 5 dog tags belonging, these dog tags, including one with a working phone number. They could read the phone number, and they called the owner.
25 years later, huh?
Who lost that dog 24 years ago hunting in that swamp.
Man.
So he had, you know, had, he said, let's see. McNeely said he owns property near the, I think it's Edisto River, and he said it's rife with alligators down there. Kenneth Cordray, owner of the shop, posted the photos on Facebook and wrote, "Ned McNeely brought me a 12-foot-long, 445-pound private land gator this morning." Blah, blah, blah. He said, "We usually don't open up the stomach, but we did today. And when we did, we found 5 dog tags, 1 bullet jacket, okay,
bullet
1
jacket.
Spark plug, a load of turtle shells, and several bobcat claws inside."
Huh.
And Mike's looking at the picture of these dog tags. Like, it's the same kind of, like, you know, you have the collar and they're kind of bar tacked to the collar, those metal pieces. And that's where they found the phone number. He added two of the tags were legible and 1 phone number still worked. The owner said he had that lease 24 years ago and lost his deer dogs in that swamp.
Well, did the gator just eat dogs that 1 year?
No,
those
were the ones they could find.
Yeah.
That was the only one that he knew.
Yeah, but they were all in that 25-year period. So what happened?
Maybe that's when they were running dogs down there.
Maybe so.
You know, and they didn't run dogs after that. Because the guy said he had the lease, he ran deer dogs back then 24 years ago.
Yeah.
It tells you how old these gators get. And then, can you imagine that? Somebody calls and say, "Hey, did you lose a dog?" Well, I don't know. When? Over 2 decades ago. Well, yeah, there you go. I know a lot was made about this story, like, oh, it's 12 foot long. Listen, it's compared to Alabama's record, world record, it's 445 pounds. But to me, what stood out is all the stuff in that stomach, especially the dog tag.
So I bet you'll check from now on what's in the gator stomach. Which
you would think the acid would eat that stuff up.
Yeah, I mean, the one of the big ones that they killed up in Wilcox County had all kinds of stuff in it. A deer in it, a hog in it, and I forget what else. A dog, I think.
Yeah, but those were recent additions because they hadn't been.
Oh, yeah, it was recent, but I mean, it had all kinds of stuff in that gator. That gator feeds a bunch.
It takes that to get 12 feet long.
Yeah.
All right, coming right back. But yeah, so there's a gator story for y'all. How about that?
That's a good one.
All right, welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors, brought to you by McConnell Buick GMC. Thank you to Chris Macaluso, who joined us earlier. Appreciate that conversation about pogies, which, of course, is, man, there's not a lot of fishing. It's not shrimp, but it's dang close to shrimp. When you think, what can't you catch on a pogie?
Everything.
That's right. That's right.
Everything likes a pogie. I don't care what it is.
That's right. That's right.
So, you know, one thing he did say, though, that was interesting, and I'm glad that he said it, was, you know, the guys that are pogie fishing around here, around Mobile.
The strike nets, right.
Yeah, the strike nets. He said that doesn't really affect anything.
That's
it
right.
It doesn't hurt anything. You know, they're catching them for me and you to go and buy a 25-pound box of them so we can go fishing with them.
That's right. And that's that's a good point that these guys doing it. And it's not just how much or not how much. It's the fact that strike net's not catching everything else.
That's right.
That's the difference.
Yeah, they're catching mainly pokies. I'm sure every now and then they'll catch something else, but, you know, they're right there.
The difference is, we're talking, if y'all didn't hear earlier, what they're doing in Louisiana is a purse seine. They're circling the whole school and everything that's in there eating on it.
Yeah, I mean, from top to bottom, I mean, they're not getting out. So I think if these nets that they're using around here, if they do catch a redfish, speckled trout, or Spanish, or whatever, I think they're able to release them pretty good and won't harm them.
Right.
So that's a good thing. I like to hear that because we do really do like our pogies to buy so that we can use them for fishing. We use them all the time.
Hey, and even if there was a way on the commercial side, you know, before, I mean, because look at this fairly. If there was a way on the commercial side, there was a sustainable amount of pogies to harvest and they weren't killing, what do you say, 100,000 redfish a year doing it.
Yeah,
then
more
that's
power
fine.
To them,
but our issue is, I mean, the biggest issue to me is how much dedication conservationists have done to making sure we have redfish. To making sure, I mean, look what we're doing right now with the limitations, whether you like it or not, with speckled trout in Alabama. That's to make sure we have a long term population. That's good. We do these things and then if you heard that here you release this fish, that fish, you know, to go breed another day because it's a big fish, and then you see it belly up after it came out of a purse seine.
Yeah.
Let some air out of your sails.
Yeah. You know, they made turtle excluders on
correct.
These.
That's all I could think about during that.
On the shrimp nets. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what they could do to help get the redfish and keep them alive and release them or whatever, and they need to study that. That's probably what they need to study is how they can, whether it's a shark or a Spanish or right. a redfish, whatever, speckled trout, whatever. Some of them are going to die for sure, and you know, a few that's okay, but
yeah,
hundreds of thousands of pounds,
correct.
Of them, that's a different deal.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So, nobody spends time in the Gulf expects them to go do that, not kill some other fish.
Yeah.
Okay. But the stats, and y'all Google this stuff, it's too much. I'm not okay with it.
I am
not okay with it. All right, let's talk a little bit about where we are now.
Snapper season.
Yes, because now hunting, except for hogs, and all, okay, stuff, but general hunting seasons are over.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, we're more tuned.
It is
tuned
for
in.
Me and you.
Yeah, now for me, it's still land management season.
I'm sure.
You know, a lot of things to do in the woods. Of course, you got to have it not rain so much so you can get in the fields and do that. But yeah, looking at snapper season coming up. So the 28th, that's a Friday, starts snapper season. That's the Friday of Memorial Day weekend, the lead-in Friday.
That's right.
And yes, it's 12:01 a.m. So the people, if you want to go out the night before and be there at 12:01 a.m., you can. I'm not going to be there. I'll wait till daylight the next day.
And you're going to have to park 3 miles down. You're going to have to park at Ship and Shore.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Exactly right. It's going to look like that, like it always. Well, it depends on. I'd say it depends on the weather. There's some days that I'm like, I'm not going, and I still look at full parking lots, people going snapper fishing.
Yeah. It doesn't matter how rough it is.
And we do have, unless something changed, and I don't have it open in front of me here, but as of last week when we were talking about it, on that weekend, so you should have, so because Amberjack is open now.
Triggerfish is open now.
And Snapper will open on the 28th. Unless something changes. Now, don't, like, go and check. I guess we can run out of time for me to check
right
my,
now,
the app on my phone.
Right now, we're going to be able to catch Amberjack, Triggerfish.
If nothing changes. I want to make sure to put that caveat in there.
And Snapper, opening weekend of Snapper season.
Which is what I, the idea I love. It just doesn't happen all the time, but the idea.
But it's just one, what, like 4 days?
Yeah, 3 days or 4 days.
Yeah. 4 days, whatever it is, till the 1st of June.
Yeah, I'm not getting this. Now it wants me to update the app. Okay, so I won't be able to give you this till next week's show, but you can check online for, just make sure. But, and we'll let you know, the show we do right before snapper season opens, we'll let you know. But for right now, the way it looks, Amberjack, Trigger, and Snapper open that first week. That's a big deal.
Yeah, and Amberjack season, you know, just opened up the 1st of May.
Right.
And it's been rough.
It has been rough.
You know, the weekends. There's been a few people go. Just like, it don't matter if it's 6-8 foot seas. Some people are going to go snapper fishing. And there's some
That's
people
right.
are going to go Amberjack fishing. So there have been a few people going out Amberjack fishing, but it's been mainly rough.
That's for sure. And that's one of the things, too, that's great about state management, that, you know, people who are new to this game, it used to be that the feds assumed the same number of us fished and caught the same number of fish every day season was open, whether it was a tropical storm or it was glass slick.
That's right.
So that's changed. That's why that Snapper app shows you that, okay, we didn't go fishing this weekend. You know, not as many people went. So that's a big part of it.
So there won't be as many people catching amberjack. I can tell you that for sure.
Yeah, slow it down a little bit.
For this season.
Also, I hadn't even told you yet, but I'm going to have to get – so I've got a little education with Mike on a trip, but I need more. So I'm in the deep drop game now too.
Oh, good. You bought you some deep drop reel rods.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I got one. I may get two. She's not listening. I may go get the other one, but I got
you better
one
go get – I mean, while they got them in stock.
Yeah, well
– you better get them.
Well – yes, says Mike. Hey, the kids need shoes. We'll see. But I've got one.
Kids need to eat, too. Fish.
They need to eat snowy grouper.
Yeah.
They need to eat tile fish. So this will be fun because I've learned a little bit with Mike, and everything else I've learned is just watching people.
You haven't learned much from me on deep dropping. We're all learning on that.
And everything else is books and websites. But so it'll be kind of a fun thing. If you're looking at deep dropping, I'm going to be trying to educate myself over the summer and see if I can figure all this out and do it. And I'll be relaying what I learned or my failures through the summer on this and try to get – basically, it was all driven by the fact that I had a bunch of window weights.
Yeah.
So I figured I got the window weights, and why not spend thousands and thousands of dollars on deep drop gear? Because I got window weights.
And gas, too, to go out and do
yeah.
it. So,
yeah, but I got window weights. I already had those.
Yeah, you don't want to lose those.
No,
yeah,
why would I?
Yeah.
All right. Prep Sports Report on the way next. We'll see y'all next week.